This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up, we'll check in with author and activist Rinku Sen. She's joined us in the program before. She's back in Connecticut to talk about the structure of race and poverty, implications for the future of young children. But first, if you listen to public radio, you know the voice of Frank Tavares. Colin McEnroe has called him NPR's Yoda. He's wrapping up his tenure as the voice who says, "This is NPR," after all the funding credits. Now, Frank is a Connecticut resident and a big WNPR supporter. Later on, he'll talk about his career at NPR, but first, he joins us to talk about his new book of short stories called The Man Who Built Boxes. Frank Tavares, welcome to Where We Live.
Thank you, John. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, there's so much that I want to talk to you about, but we're going to start by talking about your brand new book, The Man Who Built Boxes and Other Stories, this collection of short stories. And Frank, I have to ask, first of all, when did you start writing short stories? I didn't even know this about you.
We all have our little secrets, don't we? Just like the characters in the book. Ah, oh, it's amazing how it all runs together. Actually, I've been writing my whole professional life, but it's always been writing for clients. I was in advertising. I like to tell the story. I said, when I was in advertising, I learned about the power that words have. And then when I went into public broadcasting, I decided to use that power for good. But I've been writing fiction probably 15, going on 20 years. And I've got little traces of fiction in my personal archives back to high school and even a little bit from earlier. But I became serious about it in the mid-90s. And I started by working on a novel manuscript, which is no small thing to just kind of decide you want to do. And as I was completing that first manuscript, I started a second. And one of the things that struck me is these things take a long time to write. Mm-hmm. So the short stories, I started to write seriously, I guess, about 12 years or so ago. And one of the things that I liked about working in the short form is that you don't have to tell the entire story. Sometimes you can leave some of the loose ends hanging. That's okay. And you can work on several of them at the same time. So if you get a little stuck or are not sure exactly what way the characters are going to lead you at a particular point, then you can work on something else for a while. And I found that that was really very, very helpful to me in terms of developing some of my creative ability in terms of fiction specifically. And then I started to publish them in various literary journals, very affirming. And it was about that time, I guess, that I realized that I really enjoy doing this. And I have no doubt that it will be a part of my professional life from here on in.
Is your process for writing a short story substantially different than when you sit down to contribute more pages to a novel manuscript?
Initially, no, not at all. In the novel manuscript, I have more things that I have to keep alive in the back of my head in terms of subplots and things like that. But the actual process itself, and I'm one of those writers, you talk to writers and you hear the same themes. And I used to think before I started writing fiction, because my other writing, my professional writing, very, very different place in the head. Well, not all of the time, but much of the time. And one of the things that I've found is almost always I'll know how a story starts, but I don't always know how it's going to end until I get much closer to the ending. And I find that a number of writers that I talk with have the same experience. And it's that thing, John, that you hear writers talk about where they say, well, the characters tell me where we're going to go. And that's the thing that I used to kind of roll my eyes and say, well, okay, if that's how you have to justify it, that's just fine. But it's true. And as I get into a story, I mean, some of these stories that are in the book, the ones that I included in the book, some of them started with an idea for a title. Some of them started with an odd name for a character. Some of them were little bits and pieces of dialogue I overheard. Some of them started with a very loose plot, and I knew how it would end. And so it was, in those cases, a matter of figuring out how it would get from the beginning to the end. But one of the things that I have learned out of many in the fiction writing is how you have to listen to those characters. And I understand they're all in my own subconscious. I mean, I understand all of that. But it's really amazing the lives that they create for themselves as you're writing. That's one of the things that I really enjoy about writing, is I don't know where it's going to take me at any particular time, any particular part of the story arc.
What's interesting about the characters in a short story, especially the types of stories that you've collected here in this book, is that it does seem as though you have a pretty good idea of a lot of the backstory, the stuff that would make it into a novel about some of these characters. It's just, it's not exposed on the page. Am I reading that right? Or are these people who have only been partially developed, and that's why they're a short story for you?
Oh, I love hearing you say that. Because that's what I like to believe in terms of the backstory. And all of these characters, as they reveal themselves to me in my subconscious and then in my conscious when I'm writing them, I find myself asking some questions. I wonder why they have this particular way of reacting to this event. And sometimes I'm able to tease that out. Perhaps it shows up in dialogue or maybe in a reference to something that happened to them earlier. Very seldom will I actually plot this out on a separate piece of paper and say, okay, this character was born here. I do it sometimes, and this is when this happened to them, and that may show up in the story or not. And then this happened to them, and this is when they were in grade school and had the problem with a bully, blah, blah, blah. But generally, I don't. Generally, those things kind of reveal themselves. But I'm so glad to hear you say that you have a sense of those things, because I do too as I'm reading them. And then you don't have to talk about every single one of those things, because you're working in a genre where maybe you've got a dozen pages, maybe you've got 20 pages, 24 pages, something like that, as opposed to the novel manuscripts that I've worked on. Those things can be 300 pages, and it's a very, very different approach that I find myself taking. Although it's interesting, for me, this collection has 12 stories in it, and then there's a break, and then there's the first chapter of the novel that I'm working on currently. And that first chapter in an earlier version started as a short story. And I had started to send it out to various publishers, journals, literary journals, and it would come back. And one of the things that all writers know, the secret of good writing is rewriting. So every time something comes back when I've sent it out, when I've kind of let go of it, I've been brave enough to let go of it and send it out, it comes back. I reread it and I rewrite it, and then there's a different version that goes out to somebody else. And this one came back. Maybe it was a half a dozen times or so. And I read it and I said, there's something about this that's really bothering me. And I had mentioned that to myself in one of my conversations with myself as a writer several times before. And I realized, I really want to know what happens. This is not, I can't just leave it here. So I pulled it out of distribution as it was. I think I had it out to four or five different places. And I pulled it back and I said, okay, this is the next novel, because I can't stop right here. I need to know. I need to know. And then I started working on the subsequent chapters, each one revealing a different character and a little bit more of that backstory for the different characters. And so that was one time when, my best, my own plans were thwarted by my subconscious. Not always a bad thing, John.
No, sometimes it comes in handy, that subconscious. We're talking with Frank Tavares, a longtime NPR announcer, the voice of NPR, and the author of a new collection of short stories called The Man Who Built Boxes. It also includes, as he says, an excerpt of Digging Up Mr. Bradley, a forthcoming novel. I wanted to talk about a few of these different stories, but
yes.
before I get into the specifics of these stories, I have to say, Frank, an awful lot of these stories start with this guy, getting to know this guy, and it's a different guy in every single case, but you can't help but ask.
Or a gal.
Is this guy, but a lot of these guys, I think, is this guy you, Frank?
Well, that's always a question, right? And that I've asked authors when I've interviewed them, too. And I've thought quite a bit about that. And I realized that generally, no, there are bits and pieces. There are things with which I'm familiar, because I've experienced that, and so it's easy for me to lay some of that on the character in terms of how he or she might react to something, or how they might phrase something, or what they might say in a situation or not say. So some of that is reflective of me. One of the stories, it's the first story in the book, which is titled "My First Ex-Wife's Third Wedding." And that one started with the first line in that, and I'm just turning to it. The first line in that story is, "You know," my first ex-wife said, "it never occurred to me that I'd be married three times." And that was an exact quote that I wrote down after a conversation with my first wife. I'm one of these people who was lucky enough to rescue a friendship out of that first marriage. And we were chatting, and she was getting ready to marry. She had married again and lost her husband to cancer, and then was getting married a third time. And we were chatting about this, and that was the line she said to me. And I remember thinking, wow, that's I wouldn't have thought that either. And that became the first line of the book. Now, where it goes from that in terms of the characterizations, sure, some of it might have reflected me and the main character, and some of it might have reflected her and other people with whom I've had significant other relationships. But the story's not about us. But there are bits and pieces in there that definitely, when I'm reading that story for someone, that I find myself thinking, oh my, this really does touch something.
As someone who is a public figure in your work at NPR and as a public figure as a professor at Southern Connecticut State University, have you ever feared this idea that when you put out a collection of stories like this, not a memoir to be sure, but a collection of stories that clearly may show a bit about who you are and how you think, that it shines too much a light on the personal for someone who has been doing so much essentially behind the scenes or not expressing themselves in the way many other public figures do?
In one way, I don't worry about that because I've learned, it took me a long time to learn this, to have faith in my writing. As a matter of fact, I dedicate this this volume to Leo Kanellin, who was the poet laureate of the state of Connecticut. He left us about 10 or 12 years ago, I think, was when he died. But he was a very early fan of my writing, and my note to him at the front of the book, "For the late Leo Kanellin, who had faith in my writing before I did, but he taught me how to have faith in my writing." And one of the things that I like is that, well, these stories are what they are, and if you don't like them, well, I my preference is for you to like them, and if you don't, I'm sorry that you don't. But they're not your stories. They're my stories. This is what I want to talk about and what I want to write about. In terms of too much getting out there, and because I know that they're not autobiographical, a little sliver here, a little line there, people who know me well may not see me in any of these stories and be surprised that that these things came from me. Others might recognize a little character flaw that is familiar to them. But I'll tell you one thing that surprised me. One of the stories, it's actually in here, but I won't tell you which one. The publisher also had a website where some of the authors read their stories, and he asked me, would I be willing to do that? And my first reaction is, anytime in front of a mic, absolutely, I'd be glad to. And he said, well, that'd be great. I said, just give me a couple of days to think about this and how I'm going to do it and get it to you, blah, 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 blah. And then I went back and I looked at the story and I realized that the characters in this particular story, as in several of these stories, extremely profane. And I'm not. That is not the way I talk. Oh, yes, you know, when I'm really angry, I have two teenage boys, right? So when I'm really angry, there may be a word that slips out. Somebody cuts me off in traffic, but I'm really careful about that. Part of that is because I'm a college professor, and part of the way I talk with students, it might be casual, but I want them to understand that I'm trying to. This is going to sound cliche, maybe, but the way I act in class is kind of modeling for them as they move out into. I teach business communication and other forms of communication. So you know, they're professionals in training, so I try to model some of this. So I'm careful of the words that I use. I'm not saying I never swear in class or to make a point, but these characters, much more profane than me. I do not talk the way some of these characters do. And so I found myself thinking, well, the voice of NPR is going to be reading this particular story. And, you know, if people didn't know the voice, then it would be a little different. But because some of them do, and I remember I actually talked to several of my NPR pals, and I said, okay, here's the situation. What do you think? I trust your judgment. I wasn't asking permission. I was just asking for feedback. And one of them said, well, you know, the reality of it is there are some folks that are such diehard NPR listeners that somebody will figure this out and it'll be all over. And there may be nothing negative that comes as a result of this or you know, but there also may be nothing positive that comes as a result of this. And so I actually called the publisher back and I said, you know, perhaps another story, not this one. And then I sent him another story that I would feel very comfortable with. So it's funny how you said that in terms of the voice and the knowledge of the voice. I've been very careful about that over the years. Those of us in public broadcasting, most of us, there are exceptions, but most of us, I know this is true with you and the folks that I've worked with at Connecticut Public Media, we're in it because we really think it's important and we believe in it. And when I left my full-time position at NPR a number of years ago and came up here to Connecticut, I loved the fact that I was still able to be involved even peripherally by doing the funding credits. But that's something that I took very seriously. And so even though there's nothing in my contract with NPR that prohibits me from doing other voiceovers or reading my own short stories, I'm really sensitive to that. And that's going to be a hard habit to break, even once my full-time association or my regular association with NPR changes.
We're talking with Frank Tavares. He's author of The Man Who Built Boxes. It's a collection of short stories. He's also the voice of NPR. Coming up, we'll talk to him more about his career in radio. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Frank Tavares' reign as the voice of NPR is coming to an end. He joined us in studio to talk about his new book of short stories, but also about his decades working for National Public Radio. I asked him why he's leaving this position.
Back in the end of April or May, I guess it was, I had a conversation with the vice president of programming at NPR, and they had made a decision that they wanted to bring it in-house and have one person do not just the voicing, but also the producing and editing and distribution of all of the funding credits. And as some of your listeners may know, I live in Connecticut, and NPR is in Washington, D.C. So I record them. Now words are important. I don't record them up here. I voice them up here, but they're recorded in Washington. As I'm talking to you, I'm sitting in my little home recording area, which is actually a nice, large walk-in closet. All of that clothing, especially the shirts before they're ironed, that absorbs all of the sound. It's a perfect recording space. And I have my NPR equipment here and a beautiful microphone. So I record everything or I voice everything from here. It's recorded down in D.C. Usually there's not a problem when there is an emergency. which is a concept that I'd like you just to stop and think about, a funding credit emergency. I mean, who knew there were such things? But there are.
it seems as though it's a very important thing, and so I suppose there are emergencies.
Oh, yeah. So there's as a matter of fact, just before we were talking this morning, I had to re-record a dozen or so funding credits because a funder had changed something in it, and a couple of those credits are on the air either late today. Actually, I don't think they're on the air until tomorrow in several of the major programs. So the idea was that, well, if everything is in-house, maybe we don't have to worry about these quick changes. Truth be told, it's actually only been a problem a couple of times, and both times I was out of the country. what I told them is... I understand, and this might be a decision that if I was still in administration at NPR, I was a program head down there for 10 years, it might have been my decision also. But I will do anything I can to help make the transition as smooth as possible. And so they did a national search. They had 300-something people apply for it. That was winnowed down to about 100, and then they brought in three people, I understand, to do day-long meetings and auditions and so forth. And they finally made a choice. And I believe that person is going to start at the end of October, beginning of November. So as that person gets their sea legs and practices, their voice will show up probably on a couple of different programs. And then by the end of November, it should be all the new person, give or take a couple of weeks on there. So, yes, I will admit it will be very, very odd for me to hear the support for a voice not being mine.
Well, it will be odd for all of us. It's something that many people who've grown up with NPR have heard for their entire lives of listening to NPR, and many others have certainly become used to. You hinted at this before, and I guess I should ask, does this open up the opportunity for you to do lots of books on tape? Are we going to hear you selling Chryslers? Are you going to be on Monday Night Football? I mean, what's next for this? Will we hear you all over the place now, Frank?
Well, I doubt you'll hear me all over the place, but one of my other NPR friends, when this news broke back in the spring, said, all you need is one good car commercial. I thought, oh, hadn't really been thinking like that. I haven't decided what I do love being in front of the mic and reading scripts. And when I was still at NPR full-time, I remember when I was getting close to make a decision to leaving the full-time position there, in the back of my head, I figured that, you know, within a year, I've got to be doing something else. But I knew the thing that I would miss the most was being in the studio space with the dim lights, with the script in front of me, and the mic hanging in front of me also. I really enjoy that. So as this part of my professional voiceover life changes, I can't imagine not doing something else. I haven't really decided how actively I want to pursue it. I do have a day job already, and as anybody who has taught full time at a college or university knows, even though there's this myth of what an easy job it is because you're only working 12 or 15 hours a week, in class.
Yeah, right.
yeah, exactly. And I know you teach also, and preparation and so forth. When we're in session, my day job is a good 60, 65 hours a week. Doesn't leave a lot of extra time to just kind of mess around. I've forced myself to carve out writing time, which is another story. Maybe we'll get to.
You actually hinted at the last thing that I did want to ask you about, Frank, and I think that a lot of our listeners, knowing that they won't hear you on a regular basis on NPR, wanted to know what you'd be doing more of. And I think that we're all excited about your new collection of short stories and the novel that you're working on. It seems as though that this may indeed give you more time to do something that you're clearly very passionate about. Sit down and write more stories for us, right?
We all play the lotto game, right? If I won the lotto, usually it's when we're, driving home from work at the end of a very long day, even though it's a very satisfying day. But we all play that. If I won the lotto, what would I do? Uh-huh. And part of that, the answer to that question for me is I would maneuver myself so I would have much more time to write. Yes, there are times when writing is really frustrating and frightening and not fun, but I'm really nourished by it. There's nothing quite like finishing a good a section of dialogue between two characters, or nailing a prescription, nailing a description of something just right. There are a few things that feel better than that. And then going back the next day, this feels better than it. Going back the next day and realizing that that line still works, that it stood up overnight, because my tendency is to go back and change things. I listened the past couple of days. My wife and younger son and I went to visit our college freshmen at Rochester Institute of Technology. And one of the things that I did on the ride up and back, because I'm going to be doing a talk about this in Virginia at an arts center next month, is Ray Bradbury's Fahrenheit 451. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to hear him read it. And he does. There is an audiobook of him reading it. And so I listened to that in that long drive going and coming back. And first of all, I love listening to authors read their own work, because they know how, and some of them are better than others. They don't all have radio voices, and none of them will have their own radio shows. but they know what they wanted here. They know the feeling that they wanted in this line of dialogue. They know the emphasis in this particular description. And I found myself a number of times just stopping the CD in the dashboard and thinking about how he described something. And wow, I love that when I hear that in an author. And I also know that wasn't necessarily the first time he wrote it. Mm-hmm. You know, that might have been a dozen reworks of that particular sentence or that particular paragraph. Not always, but sometimes. And so yes, having more time to concentrate on the writing. Again, another very long, rambly answer for you.
Not at all. No, and I think we've exceeded the limit of your time here too. I know you're pressing up against stuff. Let me just say this: The book is called "The Man Who Built Boxes and Other Stories." It's a collection of wonderful short stories by our guest Frank Tavares, the longtime voice of NPR and a longtime friend of this show and of the station. And Frank, we are thrilled that we're going to get a chance to hopefully read more of your writing and certainly get to hear more of you as a friend here at WNPR. It's so good of you to spend some time with us, and thank you so much for being here on Where We Live.
John, it's been my pleasure to spend the time with you and also have a chance, which I seldom do, to talk directly to the listeners of my member station.
Frank Tavares is the outgoing voice of NPR. He's also been a big supporter of Where We Live. He's recently written a book of short stories called The Man Who Built Boxes. Coming up, Rinku Sen will talk about race and education. But first, let's listen to a bit more of Frank in his unlikely collaboration with Andre 3000 in Capital Cities. This is Where We Live.
Support for Capital Cities comes from Lazy Hooks. National Public Radio. Back to the Future 2. Daniel Day-Lewis. Sunsets.
This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, Christopher Capozzello has been photographing his twin brother Nick for years. His latest book of photography, The Distance Between Us, is just as much about Chris as it is about Nick. Now, Nick was born with cerebral palsy. Chris used his photography and experiences to document not only his brother's life, but to help him move past the guilt of being the healthy twin. We'll hear from both brothers about the project from the perspective of the photographer and the photographed. Join us on tomorrow's Where We Live. And I hope you can join me tomorrow afternoon on Science Friday as I sit in for Ira Flatow. Next, we visit again with Rinku Sen, who's an author and activist. She's president and executive director of the Applied Research Center and also publisher of colorlines.com. It's a website that confronts explicitly the racism that is so often at the core of our society's challenges. Now, she joined us just ahead of a keynote presentation she's giving in Cromwell next week on the structure of race and poverty, implications for the future of young children. Rinku Sen, welcome back to Where We Live.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, when you talk about the structure of race and poverty, what exactly do you mean? What are the structures behind race and poverty in America that you see?
When we talk about the structures behind race and poverty, what we're really talking about are the rules that our institutions run by and that shape our individual lives so intensely. So some of the structural and some of the rules and policies and practices that we'd want to look at in education would have to do certainly with the way that public education is financed in a particular state. It would have, going from that very large level, we might look at the individual schools and take a look at their discipline policies and their ways of engaging parents. You know, the rules, when they're written down, we call them policies, but when they're not written down, we call them practices, and both policies and practices end up creating a set of arrangements, systemic arrangements, that really influence the lives of individuals. So rather than going individual by individual, we try to take a look at how what the relationship is of the individual to the system that they're in.
So the systems in public education are very different state to state. And in a state like Connecticut, they're very different district to district. Obviously, you know, as you come to speak here, that Connecticut has the highest achievement gap. We speak about achievement gap between white students and minority students in schools of any state in the country. Why do you think that Connecticut has this problem?
Well, I think, like in many states, one of the reasons Connecticut has that problem is that over the last 60, 70 years or so, there has, in fact, been a phenomenon of white flight from the public schools. I know that this affects, plays out in Connecticut as well as other places. That doesn't mean that there aren't any white kids in the public schools, but they tend to be the white kids who have few other options. And that kind of abandonment, so to speak, of the public schools has opened the door to both the underfunding of public schools, because the constituencies that are the communities that are left using public schools have less power. And it also leads to efforts to privatize public schools and to narrow their function so that they become more more akin to a place where kids are spending time rather than learning, or, you know, in some cases really kind of warehoused rather than learning. So definitely one of the implications of doing a racial analysis of what's happening in public schools has to be an honest conversation about who is in public schools and who isn't, and how that changes the way in which we value that system.
Well, one of the things that's happened here in Connecticut is over the course of the last 20 years or so, because of a ruling at the state court level in the Sheff versus O'Neill case, there's been an attempt to desegregate public schools, essentially make more schools available to kids from within the city of Hartford to go into the suburbs, kids from the suburbs to go into the city itself. The idea behind this, Rinku Sen, is that if you have white kids from the suburbs learning next to African-American or Hispanic kids from the city, it will increase the overall achievement level. It will increase the ability for people to learn in a productive environment. Do you see this sort of experiment, this sort of idea, as something that needs to work in a place like Hartford? Or do you think that it's more than just sitting next to a kid of a different race that's going to get education moving forward in some of these places?
Yeah, I think it is more. I really believe in multicultural settings and diverse education settings. I do think that is good for the kids. But one of the things that a structural analysis would lead us to, for example, is a reframing of the achievement gap into an opportunity gap. And that, just that little bit of shift in the language that we use indicates that there's somebody responsible for making sure that kids learn, that all kids learn, beyond the kids themselves. So the achievement gap language puts a lot of the onus on students themselves, whereas the opportunity gap language begins to get us looking at what are the opportunities available to all kids. And that is the real promise of a desegregation plan, something like the plan that you're talking about. It's, to me, it's in addition to having kids sitting next to each other and working together, the hoped-for outcome would be that the kids of color and the poor kids in the state get access to the kinds of resources that provide them the opportunity to learn. Now, I have to say that I'm a little bit cynical about the notion that suburban white kids are going to be sent by their parents to study in what are certainly going to be perceived as, if not actually, lesser schools, you know, less schools that have fewer resources in the city. But if that kind of desegregation plan is accompanied by a plan to make sure that every school has what it actually needs to serve the students who are in that school, then it's going to have some potential to make the kinds of changes folks are looking for.
Of course, that's one of the big tensions in education right now, and what we'll call the education reform movement, is this idea that magnet schools or charter schools, so-called themed schools that are able to set up their own parameters for learning, are somehow going to be a panacea, that if we just had more of those types of schools, that children would learn better. On the other side, of course, there are people who say every community school, every school that you decide to build in America, should be just as excellent as the others. Where do you fall on this spectrum as we consider race and poverty in the context of what we're calling in America education reform right now?
Well, I really sympathize with parents and with students who are desperate for better schools. And I can understand why something like vouchers or charters would be very appealing to communities that are really that have been looking for solutions for a long time. The problem is that those solutions are still really isolated. And even if they were to be replicated, they're really cherry-picking solutions. They make the most space for students who have a little bit of resource in the home or in their communities to be able to make the most of something like a voucher or a charter school. So the big question is, what about all the rest of the kids, and why can't we take some of the innovative practices that are present among educators and make them a part of every school? Why do we need to control schools in the wrong direction, in my view, towards standardized testing and punishment rather than support? Those are the kinds of solutions that are going to make every school great. Having spent all of my elementary and secondary years in public schools, I know how great public schools can be, and I just wish that we were willing as a society to provide that kind of excellence to every kid, regardless of the kind of school, the kind of public school they're in.
We're talking with Rinku Sen, who is president and executive director of Applied Research Center and the publisher of colorlines.com. She's going to be in Cromwell next week speaking about the structure of race and poverty, implications for the future of young children. And this is where we live. I want to talk a bit about some of the work that you do on Color Lines and talking really in an open way about racism in America. It's something that we've talked about quite a bit on the program, about this idea of institutional racism, whether or not that's something that in America, specifically in our incarceration system, whether that's something that is widespread, and also sort of an underlying racism, the type that came to a head here in Hartford surrounding Dave Chappelle's appearance in Hartford, which got so much press and got a lot of us talking about this. Do you think, Rink Hussein, in large part, that America suffers more from a type of institutional racism or a type of hidden racism that's beneath the surface that we just don't talk about but is always there?
Well, I think we suffer from both, and I think the problem with not being willing to talk about race openly and explicitly is that we then miss the ways in which those hidden biases, those unconscious biases, are actually incorporated into the rules. Sometimes, quite often, rules that appear to be race neutral and not to have any actual racist intention behind them. So one of the realities about addressing racial discrimination in the modern era is that Americans still tend to define racism as individual, intentional, and overt. So if there's no noose hanging, it's very difficult for many Americans to recognize that there is racial discrimination present. And yet the way much discrimination takes place is actually systemic apparently race-neutral rules, and unconscious and hidden. So part of what we try to do at Color Lines is be explicit about our racial analysis so that we can rebuild the muscle that Americans need to have for doing that kind of racial impact analysis to be able to solve the problem for everybody, whatever the problem is that we're trying to address. We can't solve a problem that no one is willing to name, and it's just that when we name it, we're not in our framing, the goal is not to rout out the racist, to ask the question, who's the racist only, but to ask the question, what is causing racial inequity? Because it is entirely possible for people with very good intentions still to generate terrible racial impacts.
Rink Hussein is president and executive director of the Applied Research Center and the publisher of Color Lines. She'll be in Cromwell speaking about the structure of race and poverty, implications for the future of young children. It's good to talk to you once again. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Where We Live is produced by Tucker Ives and Betsy Kaplan. The senior producer is Katie Tilarsky. Thanks for joining us.